Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
Welcome to Hollywood and Levine. I am Ken Levine, your podcast host. Great guest this week. Jim Burrows is with me. And Jim Burrows is arguably the king of situation comedy directors. He has directed over 1,000 sitcom episodes, 240 episodes of Cheers, every episode of Will and Grace for the 8-year run originally and the remake, 76 Taxis. He has directed, like I said, over 1,000 episodes of television. He has also directed 50 pilots, including the pilot of Cheers, Friends, Frasier, Wings, News Radio, Dharma and Greg, and so many more. And he is one of the co-creators and showrunners of Cheers, along with the Charles brothers. He has been nominated for an Emmy every year between 1980 and 2005, except one, 1997. He has won 10 Emmys. He has also won 4 Directors Guild Awards. And recently, he directed the live All in the Family Jeffersons reboot. A lot to talk about. And what I really want to get into is not just, well, tell me about this show and tell me about working on that show and that sort of thing. I want to get into the actual process of directing. So we start with a little bit of his background and becoming a TV director, and then I really get into the process. And along the way, we do talk about various shows, and believe me, it's very enlightening. He was my mentor. He taught me how to direct, and he's going to teach you how to direct as well. Now, we sat down and spoke for a good hour, and I decided to break it up into 2 parts. This is part 1, my interview with Jim Burrows this week on Hollywood and Levine. Well, first of all, thank you so much for doing this. I know you are a very busy guy. So I thought what we would do is talk a little bit about your background and concentrate a lot on the process of directing, and then we'll get into some of those shows that you worked on. But you grew up in New York, and you're part of a show business family, your dad being Abe Burrows, who did Guys and Dolls. So on the one hand, you grew up in show business, which was probably a benefit. But on the other hand, you know, you had to get out from under the shadow of having a famous father.
That is correct. I think for the first 25, 26 years of my life, I didn't want to be in show business. I grew up in New York City. I was actually born in Los Angeles. I grew up in New York City. And my dad was a legend in that town. So,
right.
Thank God there wasn't an Abe Burrows Jr. I wasn't named that. But so I really did not show any interest in being in the theater. I kind of was a funny guy, but I had no desire to go into my dad's field.
So what turned you around?
I graduated in 62, not 19, not 18, 62. And I was faced with the fact that the Vietnam War was happening then. And I didn't have bone spurs.
Uh-huh.
So I
theater was better than Vietnam.
And I decided, you know, I better go to graduate school to delay this inevitable process as much as I could. And so I went to the Yale School of Drama. I had to write a play to get in, and it was not a very good play. I don't have writer's logic.
Uh-huh.
I will do anything for the sake of a joke. And so I got admitted, and a lot had to do with who my dad was. And in taking classes, and, you know, I was a playwright, classes in directing and acting, I began to see how much knowledge I had of this particular stuff. You know, I always like to say, when I was growing up, my father taught me when I didn't know I was learning.
Right, just kind of by osmosis, being around it and exposed to it. Yeah.
He would drag me to rehearsals, and so I would run around the theater, but I would sit occasionally when I got tired and watch what he would do. And so I took a directing course with a man named Nico Sakharopoulos, and I kind of said, oh, I see, that's what my dad does. That's what a director does. I think, you know, I know I'm not a writer, so maybe I can do that. So that started me on the road. And then after that, in 65, when I graduated, I had to deal with the draft board, which I was lucky enough not to be called. And I went to work for my dad as a stage manager on Broadway.
Hmm. And I guess doing that and being involved in various aspects eventually led you to directing theater, right?
Right. Well, as a stage manager, you direct the understudies.
Okay.
So you're in charge of making sure that you have, if some actor calls in sick, you have to make sure that you have a backup to play the role so the performance can go on that night. So I started directing a little bit there. And then I, when I wasn't working on Broadway, I was directing summer stock and dinner theater. And
how'd you make the transition to TV?
The first job I had when I got out of Yale School of Drama was I was hired to be the assistant to the assistant stage manager on a musical my dad wrote called Breakfast at Tiffany's, based on the book Breakfast at Tiffany's. And I was in charge. They had a cast of Broadway actors, but they also had a cast. The three stars were from California, and they didn't really know the ropes of Broadway, and it was my job to take care of them when they came off stage, tell them where to go, you know, do stuff like that. And the three stars that were in the show were Dick Chamberlain, Sally Kellerman, and Mary Tyler Moore.
Mm.
So it was not a great musical. My dad didn't write his best stuff, and he was let go in Boston. We were out of town in Boston playing to sold-out houses because you had Laura Petrie and Dr. Kildare.
Right, star power, yeah.
So backstage, it was crazy. At the stage door, it was crazy. The people lined up to get autographs and stuff like that. So my dad was let go, and David Merrick, who was the producer, brought in a man to replace my father, known for his musical comedy, named Edward Albee.
Oh, yeah.
But, you know, I love Edward. I love his work. Yeah, when in summer stock, I ran lights. I was the lighting guy for The Sandbox and Zoo Story, which were two of Edward's early plays. So anyway, you know, Edward came in, and I said to my dad, can I stay on?
Right.
And my dad said, sure. And so I stayed on, and it was a debacle. It was horrible. It was just Edward changed what it took. It made it heavier than my dad did, and he created his character, the character of Jeff, who was actually Truman Capote in the novel, would create this character, and of Holly Golightly, and if she was suffering, he could crush her like a piece of paper, and that would be it. She'd be okay. So the final moment of the show was all the sets pulled back, and there was this piece of paper on stage. And Dick Chamberlain came out, picked up the piece of paper, crushed it, threw it to the ground. And her cat would come out and play with it, and the curtain would come down.
Uh-huh.
So in order to get a cat to play with a piece of paper, you have to put cat food on it. So Dick Chamberlain came out, squeezed a piece of paper, and you heard off stage, whoosh, as all the cat food ran down his arm, he threw the paper down. The cat came out and went straight for his arm. And so what happened was, it was a disaster, because we only played previews on Broadway. And so Mary and I became really close because we were in this horrible lifeboat together. So when I was directing Summer Stock and Dinner Theater and all that stuff, I tuned in one night, Saturday night after rehearsal, and I saw the Mary Tyler Moore Show, which was done in front of a live audience. And they were doing 20 minutes a week, and I was doing two-hour play in a week. And I said, maybe I can do that. So I wrote Mary a letter. And I got a letter back about 3 weeks later from Grant Tinker, said, we're willing to take a flyer on you. And they brought me out in 1974 to do one show.
Wow. But you had never done the cameras. We're going to get into that a little bit later. But, boy, that's like a Rubik's Cube, because when you have, say, seven actors, and back in the MTM days, you only had three cameras, and you have to get singles of everybody and doubles and reaction shots and masters and everything else, and it all has to be going on simultaneous to the action. Wow. And, you know, you're walking into that. You're kind of walking into a propeller there.
My first couple of years was tough, were tough with cameras. I came out in 1974 in May, and I observed for about 5 months.
Okay.
Which means I sat in the stands and watched. I started by watching the Newhart show, because they started in early June, because Newhart played Vegas in July.
Okay.
So I would watch the Newhart show, and then I went over to the Mary show. And then I watched the Paul Sand show. And the more you watch, the more you get to know. It wasn't so critical with me with the directing of the actors. That I kind of knew. But you got to watch how the directors did their cameras. And that helped me. And then, you know, I was in October, I think, I did my first show. And it was difficult. It was hard.
Yeah, no, I met. Was it a difficult show? I mean, sometimes, you know, you get a script that's great and nothing changes and it's really easy. And other times,
I got a show that we read around the table the first reading day, because that's what you do the first time. You read it, and after the reading, I said to Grant Tinker, I said, "In a sea of Danish, I get a bagel."
Right.
And I got this script that was, Lou moves into Rhoda's apartment above Mary.
Okay.
So Lou and Mary are not only working together, but they're essentially living together.
Right.
It was written by Ziggy Steinberg. I don't know if you remember.
I remember the name. Yeah. Who can forget Ziggy Steinberg?
Yeah. I think that's the Jewish version of David Bowie's song.
Yeah. No, I'm not going to ask you to name your favorite Levine and Isaacs script. You know, I went back and looked, and you directed 44 episodes that David and I wrote.
Really?
Yep.
Oh, my God.
44 episodes. Jesus. So let's talk a little bit about the process. Do you have what you would consider a style of directing?
I do have a style. My style, it's based a lot on the kind of person I am, but it's also some spice was added by, in my observing days, I watched on the Mary Tyler Moore Show, I watched Jay Sandrich, who was like the resident director.
Right.
And how he worked with the writers. Not necessarily how he worked with the actors, but how he worked with the writers. And so that was, because Jay was very strong. And I, in doing my first show, I couldn't be that strong. I just, you know, I could,
sure.
I could
yeah.
venture a couple of ideas and stuff like that. But, you know, it took me a while to adopt Jay's full fervor that he had and stuff like that, because I was just looking for my next job. But, you know, my style is, you know, I know that ideas can only make the show better. I know that ideas come from the strangest places. I'm acceptable to ideas. I love actors to create for me because it only makes me look better. I love to talk to writers about what I think the script needs. And I always have this caveat with writers. I say, you know, I'll give you a lot of notes on the script, and 50% of what I say is great, and 50% is shit, and it's your job to figure out which is which.
Well, you do something that very few directors do, and that is, at the end of a run-through, you'll go back to the writer's room and sit with the writers and talk about what needs to be done. And, you know, your story sense is great. And it was always such a big help for us, you know. I mean, it still, it rings in my ear. And when my partner and I are writing, somebody will pitch something and we'll do a Jimmy Burrows where we'll just go, "That's weird." that's weird. You come up all the time and go, "What is this? Is weird." And you were usually right. But I remember you telling me once that if the story works, you could just have one camera filming the master and the show would work.
Yeah. Yeah. I think in the multi-camera format, if the show works in front of the audience, you know, it's going to work at home, no matter who your editor is.
Uh-huh.
Because, you know, you told a story.
Right.
And you can, if you have a bad show, you can have the greatest editor in the world, and you're not going to make any sense of it.
Right.
And it's not going to make it better. It's a lot different than single camera or movies where editing can really, really help.
Mm-hmm.
You know, for me, it's I'm filming a play, so the play has to work. And, you know, I can film it with a single camera, and the play will work.
Right. The other thing that was very helpful when you would come to the room, we would go down to a run-through, and there would be, say, a guest actor who was not doing great. And you only have so many days. So if the actor isn't doing great by day two or three, you know, you start discussing whether or not to replace him. And it was always very helpful because you could say, "Give me another day."
Yeah.
Okay. I'll get it from this guy. Don't worry.
Yeah.
You know, and it really relieved our fears. And
yeah.
You're usually right.
it you know, the thing about, because I think you're talking about Cheers.
Mm-hmm.
When you have a show like that where you have a dynamic cast and you have a guest actor who's playing in a different world.
Right.
If I will go to him at some point and I'll say, "If you don't play in their world, you're gone. You're gone, literally. I mean, we could shoot the show with you, and you disappear because
right.
You're not playing at the same level." And so that sometimes works. Sometimes, you know, we did replace people.
Sure.
We did replace people. So, you know, sometimes that works. And, you know, it's helpful for me. It's helpful for me to have feedback from you guys, too, because, you know, you guys write in an insular situation, and I direct in an insular situation. And what I think is funny when I direct, you know, I'll show it to you and it doesn't work, and that, you know, that I need that feedback, and you guys need that feedback, and that's the collaborative process that that a multi-camera sitcom is.
Yeah. Now, in dealing with actors, you have all these actors who each have their own process. And some like to rehearse a lot, some don't like to rehearse at all, some get it the first day, some need 5 days, some talk a lot, some internalize. And yet, how do you get all of those actors with all of those different processes to peak on show night?
You have to get them to walk the comic plank for you. You have to say that you're the judge. I say I'm the judge. I don't say that exactly. I say we're all in this lifeboat together, and we all have to join together, and we all have to like one another, because if you like one another or even love one another, that's going to come across. And so you deal with everybody's different process in the beginning, and then slowly they evolve. They find ways to short circuit their process. The other people find ways to have more fun. And so after a while, when you're in year two or three, or now with Will and Grace, we're in year 10, it's all about making sure that everybody has fun, because you know the actors know what they're doing.
Right.
The writers know what they're doing. So it's a process of making sure everybody has fun and not getting bored. But in the beginning, you have to work with the different styles of the different actors, and you have to blend them into one.
Okay. Well, I'm going to talk for a second about Shelley Long, because, you know, a lot has been written, you know, that Shelley was very difficult, etc. But I maintain that that character she played, especially that first season, was such a tightrope, you know, because to preserve the condescension and the pretension of that character and still be lovable and funny and sexy, it was really a tough character to play, and she played it amazingly well. Seems to me, you know, I wasn't down on the stage, but boy, watching the show and writing the show, it's like, it was worth everything. It was worth everything for that performance.
Without Shelley Long, Cheers doesn't get to year two.
I agree. You know? I totally agree.
I mean, we had a great leading man. He was a wonderful leading man. His eyes were the windows into the show. The fact that he loved everybody, he loved Coach and he loved Cliff and Norm, was your entree to the show, that you could love them too. And he was infatuated with Diane. So that led credibility to Diane's character. But Shelley Long, that character was, she was amazing.
Yeah, because you could so easily hate her.
Yeah.
You know, you could so easily hate that character.
I think half the men in America wanted to sleep with her.
Uh-huh.
And half wanted to kill her.
Right.
You know, so.
It would vary from day to day.
Yeah. But she was, you know, she was a genius. And that character was totally Glenn and Les's creation.
Yep.
When the three of us sat around and talked about what the show would be, we settled on a bar in Boston, and we settled on a sports bar. And we said, when the boys went off to write, we said, Sam Malone is going to be working for a woman. That was, which eventually happened when Kirstie came on.
Right.
But so that was, you know, that was the original intention. And so when I got back from vacation and the boys sent me the script, they had created this character of Diane, who was just unbelievable.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a tribute to them that they created this character, and it's a tribute to Shelley that she played the shit out of the character.
Yeah, she really did. You know, one of the things that you do better than any other director that I've ever worked with is you add physical bits and there, I don't know whether you know this expression or not, but oftentimes in the room we'd be rewriting and it would be 1 o'clock in the morning and somebody would come up with some idea like, okay, what about if you send a beer down the bar and it makes a turn by itself in the corner and everything. And that's 1 in the morning and go, okay, yeah, great, let's do that. You know, so we can go home. And then somebody would say, well, how are you going to do that? What, you know? And our answer was always Jimmy magic. You heard that expression? Jimmy magic. You know, we would just go, he'll figure it out. Jimmy magic. You know,
I remember you and David kept saying, because that was special effects, but you guys always said about special effects, the first thing they would say was, can't be done.
Right.
Can't be done. No, can't. But they did it. They did it with they tied a thread
right
to the handle, and Teddy send it down, and then he controlled it. He pulled it around the corner.
Right.
It spilled a couple of times, not in the show.
Right.
It was...
Well, and the other thing, you know, you would do stunts like... I remember David and I had this episode where Cliff was upset that his mother sold their home. Mm-hmm. So he handcuffed himself to the center beam of the house. And when Norm finally talks him out of it to release him, he cuts the beam and they walk out of the house. And then we had the entire second floor crash down, including a toilet. And, I mean, it was a wild special effect. And you did it in front of the audience.
Back in those days, we didn't pre-shoot a lot.
Right.
It was too expensive because we were on film then, and you had four film cameras running simultaneously. So, our shows took 2 hours to shoot.
Yeah.
Now they take 4 hours because it's all electronic. They're all cards in the cameras now. But we do pre-shoot some special effects, but I try to do it in front of the audience. I remember on Taxi, I did a show where Louis has to go to his high school reunion.
Right.
And he's too embarrassed for how he looks now.
Mm-hmm.
So he sends... He sends Bobby Wheeler instead of him because Bobby Wheeler is a good-looking guy.
Mm-hmm.
And but Louis has to go see, so he goes and he sneaks in and he bumps into a waiter carrying a punch bowl, and the waiter goes into a pillar and the entire set falls down, the entire set. And I literally did that live in front of an audience. And I had a camera on a crane that pulled back at the end like this and went over the audience. It was crazy and dangerous that if it didn't work, you couldn't reshoot it.
Right.
So, I like to do it because I love that reaction of a crowd.
Right. One thing I notice about you, again, as opposed to a lot of other directors, is... there are times when you're not even watching the stage. There's times when your back is to the stage and you're just listening. Yeah.
That's from my dad. My dad, when I was stage managing for him, I would catch him walking behind the scenery. And he would just be listening.
Uh-huh.
And I said, you know, this was a play called 40 Carats. And another play I worked with him on called... Cactus Flower. And I said, Dad, why are you walking back there? He says, well, I'm listening. I said, what are you listening for? He says, I'm listening for silence. I said, what do you mean? He says, this is a straight play, and if there's silence, I know nobody's dancing. So I'm in trouble. So I tried in the old days when I didn't have video assist, which were monitors telling me what my cameras were shooting. I would try to just listen and try if an actor on the way to a joke screwed up the setup or screwed up the punchline before it entirely came out, I would jump in. So I had to listen for that. I would jump in and go, bop, 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 because I didn't want the audience to hear the punchline said badly.
Right.
Because... Humor is 90% surprise.
Right.
And if they know somewhat of the joke that's coming, they're not going to laugh as hard. So that's what I would listen. Now I'm in my late 40s, there is video assist. I try to split my time with watching the video assist and listening to the show.
The other thing I notice about you, there are a number of directors who are really perfectionists when it comes to what is on the screen, that every shot has to be perfectly composed. And I notice with you, and I've adopted this, I've 90% of what I learn in directing is from you. I've stolen everything from you. But, you know, if an actor misses his mark a little bit, you don't care as long as the performance is there, you know, because I've seen directors will say to an actor, okay, so on this line, you'd be on this mark, and could you cheat a little bit to the left here? Could you have your arm down just a little bit so that we get this shot? And it seems to me it's like trying to be a golfer with a golf swing and having to think about 42 other things, and you're more concerned about performance. God forbid somebody is partially blocked for half a second.
Yeah, I mean, again, it's you want to capture the moment the first time. You want to capture the joke the first time. And so if you notice, especially in Taxi, the lenses were not as strong, as long as they are now. Now you can have a camera almost on another stage and shoot a close-up. Back then, you couldn't do that. So that the Taxi set was so huge that sometimes Danny DeVito in a cage, I couldn't get close enough to him.
Uh-huh.
But it was important for me, even if I shot Danny at the knees, it was important for me to get him saying the joke the first time rather than have a tighter camera on him. So I, you know, that's what's important to me. Again, it's the performance, not so much how the cameras look. I mean, I go back and watch Cheers sometimes, and there are moments when the cameras are moving and the lines were used because the performance is great. And,
right.
Now that doesn't go on as much. Now there's somebody always watching the monitors and saying that shot was no good. So you go back and get it again. But back in the old days, you didn't do that.
Okay, that'll do it for part one. Part two, next week, we get into more of the technical aspects of directing. We also talk a little bit about the live All in the Family Jefferson show that aired recently. We'll get into pilots and the unique situation that is, directing a pilot. Also, some great stories about Friends and directing plays. So that is next week, part two of my interview with Jim Burrows. Our thanks, as always, to Adam and Susie Meister Butler, to Howard Hoffman, John Wolfert, also to Bruce and Jason Miller. You can follow me on Twitter. Why are you not following me on Twitter? At Ken Levine. You can also email me, HollywoodLevine@Outlook.com. Again, that is HollywoodLevine@Outlook.com. I will write you back. I would appreciate a 5-star review. And if you haven't already, would you please subscribe? Again, talk to you next week. Part two with Jim Burrows on Hollywood and Levine. Thanks for listening. Bye-bye.
Hollywood and Levine.
1, 2, 3, 4. Those are numbers, but you already knew that. If you want to know what number you're going to pay each month for your car, use Kelley Blue Book My Wallet on Auto Trader. They're really good at numbers. Auto Trader.